Father, we thank you so much for this semester and the way you've guided us through the semester. All of the people here have been with us for so long, and it's been such a great class. And we've had a lot of fun, and Lord, we've had a lot of good discussion. And when we talk about the things we've talked about, they hit us very personally because we're talking about us. Lord, we pray that the things that we have done in this class would be, each one of us would find ways to make these things useful in our lives so that we can glorify you more. Lord, it's our purpose to understand, not for the understanding's sake, but so that we might be able to love each other more truly, be able to see things more with your eyes, and be able to see the way you see. Lord, we look forward to that day when we will stand before you and no longer look through a mirror dimly, but be able to see you clearly. And Lord, until then, we continue to study these things. And until then, we continue to study the subject that we're talking about tonight. We just ask your blessing upon it. Let your Holy Spirit be strong in this classroom. Let it be strong with each one of us. Let us leave here today with more urgency in the things that you would have us to be urgent on. Especially, Lord, whenever you said for us to love one another. Help us to be able to learn through these classes to love you more and love each other more. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Okay, you have a sheet before you called the sheet that we went through last week, or what we wrote down on the board, what women like most about being woman, what they like least, and the same thing about men. Keep that in front of you because we're going to be referring to it later on, as it's very interesting as we get through this next section to be able to refer back to this and to see how it relates so much. Last week, if you remember, we had started a series on the sex of humanity. I notice also our class is more full since this series started. I also see some new people I've never seen before. They heard we were talking about a theology of sex and came on in. We're going to continue to talk about that today. That will end our class session. We're going to talk about this other side of the views. We were presented with two views, one called the egalitarian view and one called the complementarian view. Each view or each position is trying to deal with some very real questions about the issues of man and woman. Not only men and women in society, not only men and women in the family, but also men and women within a church setting. As we kind of did a brief sketch overview of church history to see what different people had, how different people had viewed this subject, we saw that it's not throughout church history, and it's not today. There's no consensus on it. This has been a very difficult issue. It's probably one of the most sensitive issues to deal with. It's the one that I've asked for most prayer for whenever I'm up here presenting it, because it's just a hard issue. I went through this with a lady the other day that is a very sensitive lady. Just to try to characterize her, she is one that would be more on a women's lib type movement. Very angry at Paul, doesn't like the Bible because of Paul, doesn't like the way the Bible presents women, and so therefore, just as always, since she has been young, rejected the Bible outright because she saw it as a type of chauvinism. And I sat down with her. I don't know what made me do this, but I said, can you go over some of these notes with me? Because I know that you are very sensitive on this subject, and I want to be able to be sensitive to people whenever I talk about this. And can you go over this with me? And we went over it for about an hour and a half, all of these things. And by the end, she said she had mischaracterized everything about what the church had believed, or at least what the Bible had taught. By the end, she stated that this has helped her out so much because she feels more like she has dignity. She feels more like the Bible states that she has dignity, and she feels more free to be able to read the Bible because of that. She feels like God is not coming down upon women, but God is elevating women. And, I mean, I presented the two views, and at the very end I gave my persuasion about the views, and I was very persuasive as far as my own view concerning the dignity of women.
And I felt like she left there with a much better understanding of what the Bible teaches about women. I feel like so many people today in the church just have a bad view of this, don't understand it, haven't read through it, haven't looked at the different views. I feel like people throughout church history, I feel like people outside the church look at the church and have a misunderstanding of what the church teaches about this. But hopefully today we will continue to give us a better understanding of what we believe and why we believe it, and be able to relevantly engage within a culture which is more than ever bent towards tolerance, is more than ever bent towards equality, is more than ever condemning of anybody who looks down upon another race or sex just because they are part of that race or sex. And I think it's a very good thing about our culture. I think that the Bible very much presents discrimination as one of the worst things that we can do. I think that that is one good thing that this culture is looking towards and seeing discrimination. Although, of course, we have people, go to the extreme on these issues. But we as Christians ought to be able to handle these issues better than anyone else, I think. So we're going to continue here. Last week we presented egalitarianism. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say that even what Michael's saying is important in the greater scheme of this program and these courses in general. You need to understand that when he says there isn't consensus, a lot of times people interpret that as don't go into it then, don't look at the issues. And you can see we're not taking that approach. We are going to look at it and grapple with it. In other words, these classes won't answer all the questions. You may come out of here saying, yeah, you've created more questions than you answered. We don't necessarily see that as bad. We want you, rather than to have a naive faith, have a deep understanding that there are things that we struggle with. And certainly the care that Michael's taken to introduce both last class and this class is due to those reasons. There is lots of controversy here. And so we want to be very careful in looking at what the church has believed historically, how the Bible presents it, and how there is a struggle, how we have to debate back and forth, how we have to consider one text versus another. This is an ongoing issue, and there are other issues that we'll encounter in each class that we take. But part of the purpose of this is, again, for exposure. Exposure to the debates, exposure to some of the controversy. And I think Michael and I, in presenting the material, have been very impressed with how we've been able to handle this as a class and work through it. It is something that we work through, and it is something that we have to be very careful with. But you need to see this on the greater scope, that we want you to understand some of the difficult issues that we deal with in our faith. This is a difficult issue. This is always a difficult issue, especially when you start to deal with other religions. This is often a point of attack on how this is understood. So there's a big picture here that we're trying to address as well. So it's all there's some interrelation in that.
Paul Tillich once said to, in his theology, if you're familiar with Paul Tillich, he said that his purpose is to bring doubt to the believers, or doubt to the faithful, and faith to the faithless. Now, I don't think that's necessarily our purpose, but sometimes, ironically, that is what theology does. Some of the things you're most sure on, you become doubtful of, but the things that you weren't quite so sure on before, you become very strong in. And that's just the process that you go through. It's the struggle. It's part of entering into that term that we've been stating over and over again, or that phrase that we've been stating, doing theology. That's the struggle. Tension sometimes sets in, and you have to reevaluate, but it's a good thing. It's the way that God helps us to grow. So, last time we talked about the egalitarianism view. Tell me what the egalitarianism view is. Here's basically the position of egalitarianism. It's the position that the Bible teaches that all people are of equal value. Therefore, women are not in any sense, neither functionally nor ontologically, subservient to men. Women and men hold ministry positions according to their gifts, not their gender. The principle of mutual submission teaches that husbands and wives are to submit to each other equality, in the sense what they're stating is that there's no specific command for wives to always submit to their husband, but for husbands and wives both to always submit to each other, always be trying to get underneath each other.
And even again, just to underscore this, Ephesians 5:21 is the beginning. 5:22, of course, is wives submit your husbands, and then husbands submit your wives. But if you start the verse before, it says each is to be in submission to each other. So again, it's coming from the text. It's coming from how the Bible presents it. It's their understanding, or it's an understanding of how you put the pieces of the puzzle together. That is what Paul says to the church at Ephesus.
Let me run through these arguments. We're not going to go through all the arguments of egalitarianism again, but last week we went through some pretty good arguments, I think. You know, at least to cause you to stop and to reevaluate if you weren't an egalitarian before, to evaluate their position. I think the complementarian side will do the same for those of you who feel that your position is egalitarianism. They both have strong arguments. Let's talk about the complementarian position, though, today. This position is that the Bible teaches that men and women are of equal worth, dignity, and responsibility before God. Ontological equality. Now, remember, that's a key term that we need to continue to remember. Ontological. Ontological in this sense meaning their person, their being, who they are. There's no hierarchy in ontology. Just as in the Trinity, the Father is not, his being is not greater than the Son. His function may be greater, but his being is not, right? The Bible also teaches that men and women have different roles to play in society, the family, and the church. These roles do not compete, but complement each other. And you can see here the list of adherents. Wayne Grudem, John Piper, Douglas Moo, Charles Swindoll would also be placed in that. Same thing with John MacArthur. So a couple theologians, a Bible exegete, and then a couple of preachers. Now let's defend this position as we defend the egalitarian position. How would they defend this? First, they would state the Bible illustrates male leadership from the beginning of creation. From the very beginning, the Bible shows that male is to be, you can call it headship, you can call it leadership. I prefer the term leadership rather than headship because it connotes the same thing without the demeaning. See, sometimes we got to change our words in theology because words, even if they're biblical, start to take on a different connotation that don't accurately represent what they once stood for. Headship was something positive at one time. Now it's become something that's domineering. And now I think leadership is the better term. Leadership will probably someday become a bad word as well. And then you have to change it. That's okay. I don't have any problem with that. I mean, I used to be called a fundamentalist. I'm not comfortable calling myself a fundamentalist anymore. Not because I don't hold to the same principles as before, but because it's taken on a different connotation than it used to. Right?
So you can call it headship. I'll go with leadership. I think I use those interchangeably here and there.
But the Bible illustrates male leadership from the beginning of creation in that Adam named the animals. And remember how we talked about last week, that was very significant because God didn't come and name the animals. He was, in a sense, showing Adam's authority over the creation that he had placed him in, or the leadership over the creation by having Adam give the names to the animals. Adam named Eve. God didn't come in after he had named the animals and state, now I'm going to give a name to Eve. But Adam named him. He said, she shall be called woman. Another thing that is very important is God approaches Adam first after the fall, showing Adam's leadership, showing Adam's headship. He says, what have you done? And he first speaks to Adam. Also, there were no women priests. The God-ordained rulers of Israel were all male. Jesus' apostles were all male. And the bishops and pastors, presbyters, were all male as well. So the complementarian view would say that the Bible clearly illustrates male leadership from the beginning of creation.
And again, we would stress this is functional, not ontological. Okay? Ontologically equal, but functionally different rules. Okay, so these are all functional points that we see in number one.
The completeness of man, both sides would agree, comes not in a single male or female,
but the image of God is represented equally whenever both are together. And so you have the image of God not contained within the male. Christ is a unique image of God. He's a unique person because he is God in flesh. He's the incarnate God. Whereas we accurately represent the image of God in male and female, not one or the other. And so Christ is very unique in that situation because he alone, by himself, without a woman, represents the image of God perfectly because he was God.
It's always hard to look at Christ as an example on the human side because, sure, he was fully human, but he was fully God. So it always creates some interesting things. But I think the point is well taken. Had Christ come as a female, there would have been all sorts of problems, even if you only look at them culturally. Certainly that is true.
A second one, number two, the complementarian would state that Eve was created as a completer. Now, in order for someone to be incomplete, he or she must lack something. Adam lacked something that caused God to say it is not good for man to be alone. Eve was created to complete that which is lacking. And it is important to realize that she was not simply a second attempt at perfection, as some might think sometimes, right? Therefore, Eve was created with essential characteristics that Adam did not have. Likewise, Adam was created with characteristics that Eve did not have. They were created to complete each other. Therefore, the role distinction is essential for humanity to be complete. This is the crux of the complementarian position. It's that they see so much here, a unity, that it is so necessary for man and woman to both be and to be functioning properly in order for the image of God to be accurately represented within humanity. And if you try to mix the roles, change the roles, make the roles equal, then what you're doing to a complementarian is you're distorting the image of God. God can no longer be represented because we're each. I mean, if males were trying to usurp the position of females, or females were trying to usurp the position of males, we are distorting what the image of God is. The image of God is only complete, according to the complementarian, whenever both are functioning properly.
Better to say make the roles the same rather than equal. The roles are equal in value, but trying to make the roles the same, that's something that our culture has tried to do. We can talk about other examples of that, Bill.
Yeah, it really is. From the complementarian perspective, the egalitarian is trying to do just that. It doesn't recognize that whenever Eve was created, she was created lacking many things that the male fulfills. And whenever the male was created, he was created lacking many things that the female fulfills. And then whenever you try to state that they both have everything, they both have all that's necessary to be fully the image of God, the complementarian would say the egalitarian is distorting the image of God rather than helping.
Again, we'd want to emphasize, and we said this last week, and we'd just to say it again, note that Adam is called incomplete even though he is without sin and in perfect relationship with God, walking in the garden with God, having that one-on-one relationship with God. In that condition is when he's called incomplete. And so it's very important because it's very hard for us to understand in an individualistic society or an individualistic culture. We are so programmed to look out for ourselves, even when we don't want to. We often present the Christian faith in the same way. You need to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, almost as if you don't need to have a relationship with the church. And we're gonna build on this a lot more when we get to ecclesiology, the study of the church. How necessary not only that men need women or a man needs a woman to be complete, but how the church functions under the necessity of each other. A very simple thing, just to throw out there, is look at the gifts of the Spirit. I don't carry all the gifts of the Spirit with me, nor does Michael, and nor do any one of you. But when we all meet together, we have the full manifestation of the Spirit, only in community. So there is a built-in necessity for us to need each other. Here we're talking about man and woman. Later we're going to talk about the community in general. But note the move against individualism, which is exactly countercultural to how we live today. Very hard for us to think this way, but again, that Adam is called incomplete at the point where he has a personal relationship with God. Question? Yeah, we have to walk. Understood. God is maybe more fully glorified by multiples than singles.
we could go with that route, but we want to watch that we don't create God with a need. God didn't create Eve because he still had a need that Adam couldn't fulfill. So we don't want to present it that way, but certainly that maybe God is more fulfilled or more praised by the woman and the man functioning in unity together, and we're moving in that direction.
And it is, and it does have to do with the image of God in which we are created. We are created as social beings, and to have social beings, you have a society that must be built. And this society is represented whenever the complementarian view is put together, that we're not individually equipped to be able to we're not asexual beings without a sex that is producing of our own, that we're able to function a society in our own. We have to have each other. And God tries to teach us that from the very beginning. And it's very important what Rome said is that our culture rebels against that in every area. In society, in the church, between men and women, everywhere you go, you have an individualistic society that is more and more in rebellion, especially from the modernist period that we're coming from, is in rebellion against this idea of complementarian, that we need each other. We want to be able to state we don't need anybody. We are individuals. We are autonomous beings to be able to do everything on our own. And the Bible's continually pushing us back to the community and stating you need each other. That's the way God has created you from the very beginning. Adam said, this is the one who corresponds to me. This is the one who fills what I'm lacking. And all of us must have that community, whether in church, society, or wherever, that we have somebody that is fulfilling that which is lacking.
You can even see an example in commercials like, do you want financial independence? Sort of like that's something that's possible. How could you possibly be financially independent outside of the economy? I mean, your finances are tied into the economy. So if you're financially independent and the U.S. dollar goes down in value, how could you be independent? Unless, okay, you don't have U.S. dollars, you have gold. What if the value of gold goes down? Okay, you don't have gold, you have stocks. No matter what you have, it's always dependent on everything else, even financially, even in our societies, in our families, as Michael just said. Everything in our society is programmed for individualism. But I consider you, every time you hear that those words independence or individualism, whether it be on TV or in a movie or in day-to-day conversations, consider what it is that they're trying to offer. What is it that they want individualistic? Because basically the Bible will always move against that. For the community, for the closeness or the integration of one with another. It shows our desperate need for each other, and it's the most difficult thing for us in the Western society to grasp. Much easier to teach something like this cross-culturally, where they fully understand they need each other. It makes perfect sense.
In marriage situations, this applies. You know, it's that whenever someone comes together in marriage, it is as if the man is stating, I have found the one who corresponds to me. And so, yes, I mean, in that sense, we have the ability to be able to find the right person. I think it's, something of a Western phenomenon that we can go off and find our own mate, whereas no other cultures or no other people in the world history really has been able to do that. But the father has to find one, and he does the same thing. The father finds someone that corresponds to his daughter or his son.
And understanding that principle of marriage in the biblical sense, again from Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, and be subject or be in submission to one another in the fear of Christ. So if the woman is coming in submission to the man because of the fear of Christ, and the man is coming in submission to the woman, then you're getting exactly what you're referring to, Linda, and that's that perfect unity, that both are in submission to each other. Why? For the fear of Christ. Not because one is going to dominate the other. It's not an issue of domination. And so it's very important that we understand how the Bible presents it. Because what Michael said is very, very interesting. Culturally, we're the only culture who really has walked through the steps of towards marriage in the way that we do. With sort of, if you will, free will. As we all know, that's not true. But if you will, we freely choose who we want. But it's important to understand if both are coming into the marriage union in submission one to another, then they're following the biblical pattern. And you're right. God can be glorified, and we can better bear the image of God for each other, for the community, and even for the nations.
But also to the complementarian, they would see this relationship as not one that is, whenever you state the one that perfectly corresponds, we think of something, oh, that it's just a smooth relationship. It works out perfectly. But that's not what we're trying to state either. The corresponding is from God's eyes. The corresponding is that this is what you need, even though the relationship may be very abrasive.
correspondence does not mean non-abrasiveness. Correspondence means that sometimes this which corresponds to you fills what you're lacking, but you don't feel like, because you are who you are, don't feel like you need this, you know, because maybe you're that type of person to where you don't feel like you need to have an emotional side to you. You do everything rational, like most men. You know, we've got it figured out. And so when we see the emotional element come in, we say, well, that just doesn't make sense. You know, you need to become more like us. You need to think more like us because we've got it going on here, you know, with our thinking. But God doesn't state it that way. He says that it corresponds and that we cannot be set in our mind that this is not needed. The emotional side is not needed. That it's not very important. Same thing with women. Women who are more emotionally acute, emotionally aware, emotionally sensitive, able to have that intuition. You know, that's the most important thing to you. It really is. I mean, it's on your sheets here. What you like most about being a woman. And sometimes you want to force the man to be able to become like you so that he no longer corresponds to you. You see, we try to make people no longer correspond to us. But that correspondence sometimes produces the abrasiveness. And this is just a, theologically speaking, from a complementarian perspective. This is not a family life conference I'm going through here. It's not. I don't have my notes from the family life. It's just true stuff. The one that corresponds to each other.
Just before you say, and again, the key is in submission. And what Michael's talking about, that abrasion that can happen in the relationship, that means that we are choosing to submit, to allow the if you will, the complement of the opposite sex or of the other person. So it's in submission. Exactly the point that it isn't necessarily simple.
Yeah, that's right. I think that the idea of God the idea of redeeming all things, redeeming that which was lost in the garden, has to dictate our theology because it is a redemption, not a recreation.
Yeah, I want to say from a perspective of marriage because Christ does state that. I mean, that's confusing to me a little bit whenever he stated that we wouldn't need anybody in heaven. Only if he's speaking towards procreation. I understand that, but the completer aspect of it, that's confusing to me in the restoration of that which is lost.
We have to, at minimum, understand the future as being a perfection of the present. At minimum, the minimum that heaven can be, or better stated, the minimum that the new heaven and the new earth will be, is a perfection of the current earth. It's probably more and more glorious in more ways than, but at minimum, it's a perfection. And so there's still going to be order. God is a God of order. And so if you can imagine perfect submission, if you can picture, to go back to the marriage example now, and imagine perfect submission, the husband to the wife and the wife to the husband, imagine a marriage relationship without sin of two perfected peoples, there still is a sense of leadership or headship in that state. But it's the woman is not dominated, is not in any way misused, and the man in turn is not in any way functionally out of line, and yet there still is that. So I think that's the minimum that we can do, again, with very little textual evidence to go to. A very good question, very, very difficult to answer, but I would say minimum, you have to go with a perfect version of the current earth to understand that.
No, I hope that's exactly the opposite of what we were stating here. I mean, we aren't stating that man was created for woman individually only. It's that the society, humankind is incomplete if it's man alone, humankind is incomplete if it's woman alone. But whenever we have both functioning, I mean, a single man functions within society and he's gifted and he contributes and he fulfills that which is lacking just as much as a married man within society. Same thing with a woman. A woman does not have to feel like she is lacking because she is single, because she still contributes to in her even her nurturing and nesting. Women are used all the time for that in a general sense in society, friendships and relationships that they have. All of these gifts are still in use. It's not as if we have to have some type of marriage relationships for this image of God to become clear within you. It's something that is a society thing, as well as a marriage thing.
They're incomplete, not as an individual, but if the world was just men, then men are incomplete in general. Okay? The world is just women, but because there's both men and women functioning in the world, that's what brings completeness. In other words, we're not talking about Adam is complete, incomplete, and requires a wife. We're talking Adam is incomplete because all he is man, and there's no woman. And so by creating Eve, there's brought completeness.
And he didn't create, and you know, we use the joke about, you know, he didn't create Adam and Steve, you know. But we could use this in a society situation as well. We don't even have to use it in a marriage situation, which this applies just as much to marriage. I'm not trying to devalue the creation story of marriage. It applies to marriage, but it applies to society as well and the church as well. But he didn't create Adam and another male because that wouldn't have completed what Adam was lacking. That would have done nothing for him. It would have done nothing for society. It would have gone the opposite direction. God knew what he was doing from the very beginning. That's why he brought all those animals to Adam to see what he would call him. And there was not found a helper or a completer that was suitable for him. And so God is using that type of rhetoric to teach us today that we have to understand this community that we live in as male and female. And really, I think more than anything else, and especially according to the complementarian, appreciate one another for those giftedness. Be appreciative, men, of women. Women, be appreciative of men. I know that there's the faults in every one of us, and I know that there's the extremes that each sex goes to, but you wouldn't be able to function. You wouldn't be able to function without us, and we wouldn't be able to function without you, according to the complementarian. Number three, the complementarian would state Paul. Now let's deal with Paul. Let's deal with Paul and his supposed chauvinism that is very difficult to deal with sometimes. Paul constantly has to address women who are failing to understand the importance of their role as women or who were in outright rebellion against it. These women were blurring the God-ordained roles and attempting to usurp the role of man. This rebellion is part of the curse, according to the complementarian. Now let's look at some of the passages. First, we would look at the curse once again. And we would see that in Genesis 3:16 it says, to the woman I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth, the first curse. In pain you will bring forth children. Second curse, yet you will want to control your husband, and he will rule over you. You will want to usurp your husband. You will want to as it's used two passages later, whenever it talks about God speaking to Cain, the same Hebrew word is used. Sin has its desire for you. Sin wants to control you. But you must what?
Master.
You must master it. And so you must turn around and control it. So it's a control issue. Some people have whenever a complementarian would laugh at this, because some people have sometimes looked at this passage and said, well, we're trying to dodge the obvious implications of the curse here and to state that it's not women really wanting to control men. The desire here is the same word for desire that is used in Song of Solomon for the man's desire for the woman. And so they say part of the curse is that the women have sexual desire for the men now. But the men, and I thought, well, you know, I'm not sure if that's necessarily a curse, first of all. Second of all, I don't think it's true. Part of the curse is that the women will want to control the men. And you don't have to have your husband. You can have the society, again, in general, because that's what we're talking about. But he will rule over you, and he will rule over you. Now, let's take this, and now let's jump ahead a few thousand years to Paul writing to Timothy. Whenever he speaks to them about women in the church, he states to Timothy, "I do not allow a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created, and then Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression." Now let's stop right there. Kind of a difficult passage to deal with, because Paul does seem to be being very harsh here. Let me give you a little bit of the background first to try to help you to understand what is going on. Now Paul, whenever he's writing to Ephesus, or whatever letter he's writing to, the church was really producing a liberation movement for all people, especially in a very strongly male-dominated society. The church comes in and introduces ontological equality. Okay? The church comes in and sets women free from the bondage that they were in. Now, if you were to read some cultural issues of women during this day, you would say that Paul was revolutionary towards women. He was not degrading to them. He was one who came in and was in the process of setting them free. His words were different than anybody's words of that day. They were much, much less severe. And so Christianity, especially Christ being the main example, came in and he had women who were following him everywhere he went. He had women who were sitting at his feet and he was teaching them. Now, this was not the way that it happened in a Jewish society, where the women only could go to the outer courts, the court of women, and in the synagogues they could not come into the synagogues and learn. And whenever they weren't even really permitted to learn anything, especially of the religious nature. They were not permitted to read the Bible in most parts. And so there was no permission given to women to learn. But here comes Christ, and the first thing he does is he has women, especially read throughout Luke, who emphasizes this more than any other. The women were his supporters. They were the ones sitting at his feet. They were the one weeping whenever he was dying. They were the one who were at the cross. More women than men were at the cross. Because of all the men, where'd they go? They ran. They were scared. But the women were not scared. So you have a very much an elevation of women, especially within the gospel, something that is totally countercultural. Now, what Paul seems to be doing in his churches is these women who were both up to this point unlearned because they were forbidden to learn, and going through kind of a liberation movement stating, hey, look what's going on here. You know, the church has liberated us. We can do whatever the men do, right? We do not have to be pushed down anymore. We can do the same things the men do. And so it seems to be that there was a lot of women in these churches that Paul wrote to that were getting up and talking and speaking. And, you know, sometimes disrupting the service because, I mean, you could have had this from a man as well. But generally speaking, it was the women who were doing it because they were the unlearned. Now, think of this situation. I'm getting ready to teach sanctification soteriology, right? And me and Lynn are trying to figure out who to let into sanctification and soteriology. Because we feel like only those who have learned humanity and sin are able really to get in and take part in the discussion. We don't let anybody in the program that hasn't taken intro to theology. Because we don't want people to come in and ask questions that we've already covered in intro to theology. And if somebody does come into sanctification and soteriology that has not taken humanity and sin, they won't have a clue how to deal with the free will issue. You and I have already dealt with the free will issue. If somebody comes in now and calls me and says, can I take this class? And I say, well, you'd be taking humanity and sin. No. I say, well, can you watch the humanity and sin classes? And if they say, well, I really can't, but can I still take it? I'll say, you can, but you can't say a word in it. You have to sit silent. I mean, you cannot be asking questions that have already been covered in a previous class. That's the purpose of us being this way. Now, many people would say that's the same thing Paul's dealing with here, is that there was disruptions because of this liberation that had come out and because of the excitement to where Paul was kind of pushing down this. So in one sense, whenever he says, I do not allow a woman to speak, he's stating I don't allow a woman to get up and teach and to speak on the things that are being spoken on. That's just one view. I think it fits the best with the cultural situation that's going on.
One thing that may be helpful, anytime you look at biblical culture, it's important that you don't confuse biblical culture with culture that is biblical. When you're looking at the culture of the Bible, the culture of the day when the Bible is being written, you cannot say then that that is the culture that the Bible prescribes. In other words, the way society was functioning was as a Greek culture. It was pagan, and it was very pagan even in the nation of Israel. So what Paul is saying is, as Michael's already said, is countercultural. So the culture of the Bible, and this is very hard to sort of get your minds around, but the culture of the Bible is not biblical. We call it the biblical culture because it's the culture in the day when the Bible is being written. But it isn't necessarily the culture that the Bible prescribes. The Bible never wanted men to dominate over women the way they did. However, interesting enough, you go back to the curses, you'll see that that was the tendency of sin. And guess what? In a sinful culture, that's what was produced. So the Bible is trying to rectify that. So we don't go back to understanding the day of Paul, the day of Timothy and the church at Ephesus, and we don't go back and say, that's the culture we want. That culture isn't necessarily biblical. But that was the culture of the Bible, and that's the culture that the Bible is being written into. And so part of our job, and even some of the stuff we talk about in Bible study methods, is to understand some of those cultural things, i.e. the easy one that's really sort of neutral is women wearing hats. We understand there was a specific purpose in that culture which carries no meaning in our culture right now, and may carry meaning in our culture later on. So anytime we're looking at the culture, it's very important that you're not trying to say, I understand that their culture was biblical. No, their culture was the culture that was in place when the Bible was being written. And there's a big difference there. So Paul's looking at the current culture and saying, this is not good. And this is not according to how the Bible would have designed the relationship or society to function. The culture of the Bible is functioning as Alexander the Great set it up when he conquered most of the known, if not all of the known world. And that Greek culture, later taken over by the Romans, who basically built the infrastructure, it's still functioning as a Greek secular culture, very influenced by people like Plato and Aristotle and Socrates. And so it's into that milieu that Paul is writing and trying to correct culture, especially the culture in the church. All that said, we too need to be aware of how our culture today affects our churches of today. That we are very victimized of our secular culture pervading throughout our church. For example, our culture is very secular, and as a result, for the last 200 years, our culture is very individualistic, and as a result, for the last 200 years or so, our churches have become very individualistic, and our Christianity has become to be interpreted as very individualistic. Simple example, you would never read in the early church of someone offering a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. That's a modern phrase which is in fact very cultural. It's not biblical, you won't find it in the Bible, and you won't find it in church history. That comes out of an individualistic culture. So it's very important that as we grapple with these things, and Paul is writing into a pagan culture, which is in the culture of the time of the Bible. And that's how we're dealing with it. It's very, 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 very cautious as we work with these cultural issues. And that's really what we're trying to show here.
Jason. Yeah, and what I was really doing is introducing us to the next few verses that we're going to look at, the whole cultural situation in which these verses were written. Now remember, here's what was going on. You had a male-dominated culture. Let's look at this, the pendulum effect. You had the male-domination culture. You had the liberation come in and try to equal out all the roles. So you have equal roles over here, male domination over here. What kind of happened was right whenever the Christian movement started, it moved from male domination and swung all the way over here to where they were trying to push equal roles. Non-complementarian, we're all the same, right?
Or equal function.
Yeah. And then what Paul essentially is trying to do is not move it back here, but just balance it out and to state, no, we've got to move to a complementarian view and understand that we were created. Move back to what we were created for. And what Paul is essentially doing is taking the women out of the place that they were trying to take here as far as teaching and stating, no, there's a role for you. Now let's read this. I do not allow a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. The idea is not that you cannot ever speak, but the idea is that you cannot ever speak in this situation, which was bringing up the teaching. For it was Adam who was created first, then Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Now what does Paul refer to justify this claim? He refers to creation. That's a very important thing to look at, because if it was purely cultural and only cultural that this applied in, he wouldn't refer back to creation. He'd refer to something in the culture maybe. But he refers to how we were created to justify his statement that he does not allow a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. We'll talk about the exact meaning of that in just a minute. But whatever he's stating, it's not embedded within culture. The principle is embedded within creation. Does everybody understand that and see that?
Right, and maybe I made that slightly unclear in what I said. The real issue at hand is the functional, that's what was going on culturally, was that women were misunderstanding their functional role, which is different than a man's functional role. Ontologically equal, functionally different. Paul?
But Paul says, just in case, and this is a very sensitive side of Paul coming out right here. He's trying to make, just in case this kind of knocks people off their high horse, this cultural pendulum has swung this way to equality in roles. And what he's basically doing is saying, women, you have your roles, but this is not it. And he says, but just in case you don't think you have dignity, he says women will be preserved, or it could be just as well translated. It's the Greek, same Greek word that we get our word saved from. But the best translation to catch the spirit of what Paul is trying to state is, but women will gain their dignity through the bearing of children if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. So what this is essentially stating is that women gain their dignity within their own roles. Men gain their dignity within their own roles. Now, this idea of childbearing here doesn't necessarily have to mean that only if you have a child that you receive your dignity. It has the idea of this: women have their role in their nurturing and nesting, in their sensitivity, in their ability to have intuition, to be emotionally acute. Women have their function that way. The reason why he used childbearing here is because that's the primary avenue through which that function is illustrated. Right? Does everybody understand that? Women, you have all these, Paul is stating, you have all of these different gifts that come along with you, and you gain your dignity through that. The primary illustration of where those gifts lie is through childbearing, but it's not necessarily the only place where those are illustrated.
And again, culturally, you have to understand childbearing is very highly elevated in that culture. And so some may say, well, why childbearing? Because it's not elevated in our culture. And there's an example of comparing the cultures, because that was highly elevated. You married a woman so that she would bear children. Why? That was a good thing. And here, in our culture today, that's not how childbearing is expressed. At bare minimum, our society would say it's neutral. It probably isn't really neutral, but you'd see. And so that's dignity is being raised, but sometimes we culturally misunderstand that, and that's more what I was trying to get at.
But we don't want to take away from the great dignity that is in childbearing,
that's
though,
right.
As you all expressed
right.
as well. I mean, each one of you said the very first thing, childbearing, motherhood, those types of things bring you the dignity that you have, along with many other things. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about what the role of teaching or to exercise authority over a man means, because among complementarians there's going to be many different views about this. Some would strictly hold that in no instance can a woman ever teach a man. Some would hold that it's just only whenever there is not a male to teach you can, or whenever there is no males available. Kind of like in Judges, whenever Deborah came in and judged Israel, the only reason they would state she judged is because there was no males found. There were no kings in Israel. There were no males standing up doing their job. And so therefore, out of necessity, God brought a woman in. And then some people would state that this simply is in the progressive tense. I do not allow a woman to teach always, or to continually be teaching, and to continually be exercising authority over a man, in the sense that they are the primary spiritual caregiver to the male, or they are the pastor, the shepherd, the primary guide of the male. And so there's all kinds of places on the spectrum you can fall in. All of them, to me, are really exegetically, it's difficult to tell. You know, it's difficult to tell what he's stating. Because obviously here, whenever he says to teach, he's not talking about in any sense can a woman ever teach, because to the Corinthians, he talked to the female prophetesses about how to prophesy in the church. And so it's difficult. I take the idea right now, and this is one of those things, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how sure are you? I'm about a 1 or a 2. You know, I can go back either direction on this. But I take it in the sense that women cannot exercise the spiritual headship of the pastor, the primary caregiver that is continually leading. And whenever I say cannot, I'm almost a balance between the judge's view as well. Whenever you have Deborah being a judge, whenever I say cannot, it's almost like the other day. Whenever my wife was, she's a Mother's Day out. She works there a couple of days a week, a Mother's Day out at Prestonwood, and she was up there the other day, and she hasn't been doing it since Will's been born.
And she, whenever she went up there, she came in back home and she said, you know, I felt so good because there were so many people that requested me. And all the mothers are coming back and fathers are saying, can we get Christy again? And I was thinking to myself, you know, I wonder if there's any men there that do that, you know, the Mother's Day Out thing. And I thought to myself, if there were any men up there, I would always choose the woman first to take care of my children. I just would. I just know that they are more equipped to be able to handle children and care for. My most prized possession, I would place in the hands of a woman. And you, whenever I say always, I mean that in the sense of, you know, if there was, it's not as if I would never make an exception. Ever make an exception. It's just that's always the bent I go to. If there's always a woman available and the woman's good, you know, I'll put them with a woman. But if there's a man and no woman, all men, you just put them with a man. And so I'm kind of like that. And I think that's maybe where Paul is going. I think that he's assuming there's the options there. He's assuming whenever you have a choice of teachers, there's going to be both males that are equipped and female. But he's saying always choose the male. Just like I would always choose the female in those situations. And so in all these situations, and that's the way that I'd approach it. If I was a head pastor of a church, I would always tend towards the male in these situations, in the situations that's what their role is, and I'd always tend towards the female in the situations that is what their role is. You see what I'm saying? I'm kind of wormy about this, aren't I?
Well, sometimes I
drive home and listen to the radio, and I listen to Elizabeth Elliot, and I learn a lot from her. And so I'm not saying in any sense that a woman can't teach, and I don't think that that's what Paul's talking about. That's why I use this in the progressive sense. Continually over a full congregation, continually over exercising the role of a pastor, a bishop, an elder, however those are exercised. But not in any sense am I saying women can't teach. Not in any sense am I saying women can't teach women. And shouldn't it? I think that there are some very gifted women teachers.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that's a good example of the Deborah, you know, illustration.
But even furthermore, you look across culturally, predominantly in especially third world countries or countries where Christianity is extremely difficult, if not persecuted for, it's the women who lead the church. And there's even a disqualification for North Americans to come in and impose how the church should be governed, for example, in a place like China, where it's mostly women who are available. And again, that would be understood on a complementarian perspective as there aren't men available, and there truly aren't. And we would have some here who could attest to that. There are places in the world where the church is predominantly women, and even here, if you were to take the average example where one in the marriage is a believer and the other is not, you tend to assume that it's the woman who's the believer and the man who is not. And again, that could even be functionally because women are more sensitive to things of the Spirit. There would be lots that could be drawn from that. But certainly, again, understanding that we understand it very, our tendency is to understand it within the, only looking at the eyes of our own culture. Looking at other cultures helps to fill in how this can be understood.
Yeah, and you know, that's exactly it. He's stating that women's role is more, because of their role, because of their giftedness in other areas, they're more susceptible in this area. Just like it could be the same thing about men. I mean, if he could have written something about men, and if men in that day were experiencing some type of liberation movement trying to usurp the role of men, he probably would have given a similar illustration about how man cannot do this or should not do this, and given an illustration of how he has failed in this area once or twice. I mean, the difficulty with this illustration is not only did Adam end up eating the fruit as well, you know, he listened to his wife, but you're right. He does seem to be going to that the woman being deceived points to the better ability for man to teach. I'm confused about it, though, because the man was deceived as well and ate. So I don't say I have the perfect interpretation.
he didn't fill his functional role in making the proper decision. And who does God hold responsible in the end? He blames Adam, even though Eve was deceived first. So, yeah, I would see those as a difference. Eve was deceived, and Adam was, I'm not sure what the right word is, but Adam did not fulfill his role in making the correct decision. Adam was... Adam didn't use discernment. Adam was too weak to take the correct stand or something like that. Adam gave in when he shouldn't have. One of the problems is, and I think there's some truth to that, the problem comes that we then, and this would be a male problem, we elevate logic as if logic is right and emotion is wrong. Okay, and that's where it becomes very problematic, because that simply isn't true. Logic has its value, as does emotion.
Yeah, remember, on our stage of truth, they're both there. They're both essential. We're going to have to move through the rest of these, or we're not going to get through, so let's keep on going. Let me read a couple more scriptures that talk about this. In 1 Corinthians 14, Paul states, "The women are to keep silent in the churches. They are not permitted to speak, but are to subject themselves, just as the law also says. If they desire to learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is improper for a woman to speak in church." And again, if you place this within the cultural situation of the day, it's understandable. I think it brings out, especially whenever Paul, a couple of chapters earlier, is talking about women standing up, prophesying, that sort of stuff. Women are commanded to teach in different situations. There's obviously a cultural situation that is causing him to state this, just like there might be a situation in which I state all newcomers to this next class are to remain silent. You can be observers, but you cannot be participators. And then in 1 Corinthians 11:3, it says, "But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and man is the head of the woman, and God is the head of Christ." Now, this is speaking at the point of the issue of women having head coverings. And the principle there most basically, has to do with the submission aspect. The head coverings, how those didn't show submission is up for debate. But the basic idea is that the women were kind of taking the initiative to state, "I'm no longer in my role as I was before. Because I'm a Christian, I don't have this role." We have equality of roles, functional equality. And what Paul is basically doing is, again, trying to put the pendulum back, you know, trying to state, hey, let's get in our right roles if we're going to function correctly as a church. He does this with the people with spiritual gifts as well. He says, hey, you don't be seeking this gift. You don't be seeking this gift. This gift is for that. That gift is... He's always having to keep everybody in line and to state there's functions which we all individually have. And again, there was a big problem with women of that day who were experiencing this liberation movement but not being able to see the proper function of roles of both male and female. And so that's why Paul seems to come down a little bit hard on this. Also, he says... in Colossians 3:18, "The wives are to submit to your husbands as is fitting to the Lord." Again, he's placing the role now within the family, and he's talking about how this functions within a family. Now, what's going to be interesting in just a minute is how little he writes to the women, but how much he writes to the men. And we'll explain that in just a minute. Next, he says, "Women are to be sensible, pure workers at home, kind, gentle to their husbands, so that the word of God may not be dishonored." So again, he's regarding the role of women, and he's putting women not taking away dignity, but in a lot of respects, he's giving them dignity, as we'll continue to illustrate. Number four, the complementarian would state the New Testament writers constantly have to address men who abuse their role as leaders. This is part of the curse. The instruction to men, however, is not to stop leading, but to lead in a way that is sensitive, encouraging, and loving. Men, he understands, are abusing their role. They're trying to get the pendulum to go back here. Women are trying to get the pendulum to go here. And Paul has to address this. Remember in Genesis 3:16, part of the curse, again, was not only that you will have pain in childbirth, not only will your desire be for your husband, but he will rule over you. And that word for rule is a harsh rule. He will harshly dominate over you. And so Paul has to address the men. And whenever he writes in Ephesians chapter 5 to the husbands, this is something that was completely unheard of in the culture.
you did not write instructions to a man on how to treat a woman. The man could treat the woman however he wanted. The women had the instructions. That was very common. Usually the women's instructions were very long. And there was no instructions to a man because the man didn't need instructions. He was the one who was in power. He was the one who was dominating. But the women were to act sensibly in this way. But Paul turns things around. That's whenever, I mean, if you're reading the literature of the day and then go to Paul, you're like, what is Paul doing? He's creating a revolution in the culture. Because all he states to women is one line. But look what he goes and look how he talks about women, or instruction he gives to a husband. Husbands, you love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. For he loves his own wife, loves himself. Nevertheless, each individual among you is to love his wife even as himself. Now that was just kind of blow-me-away type of literature. I mean, it's completely countercultural. Peter does the same thing. He says, husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman. And show her honor as the fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered. Now, there's a couple of things that stand out very, very much in this verse, and it doesn't have to do with a weaker vessel or the someone who is weaker. It has to do with her being a fellow heir. That was the contribution. That's the straightening out of that which was broken. She is a fellow heir. It's not a heir that is underneath you, but a fellow heir, someone that is a co-heir, someone that is inheriting with you. So treat her as if she is equal with you. She is. This is speaking of the ontological equality. And then it also says that if you don't, what's the consequence? What are your prayers? Your relationship with God. If you don't fulfill this, if you here's not only instructions to a man, but the penalty is the worst of all penalties. If you're not treating your wife in the right way, if you're not being understanding to her, if you're just sitting there saying, you know, I'm the rational person, she needs to figure out the way that rational men act and start getting in line and understand that we are the ones that are the stronger ones, and instead of gently dealing with women, instead of understanding their sensitivity, instead of now not trying to get them to become rational, but you trying to become sensitive along with them, if you don't do that, Peter says, your prayers, your relationship with God is going to be hindered. That your communication with God will be ceased, because hindering of prayers means to stop the prayers. Yeah, it is. It is. It has to do with the roles. The roles, and men, you know, just the roles of rationality and the hardness that we have in a lot of ways would not be seen as weaker, gentle. Gentle might be a good word. Whereas women would be seen as gentle. You know, because the roles demand that. Because the roles demand them to be able to be that way. And then in Colossians as well, Paul says, husbands, love your wives and do not be, what with them? Harsh. The same idea. It's the tendency of man to be harsh with the woman. It's the tendency of man to try to, as the curse states, harshly rule over them. And Paul is trying to bring us back and state, don't rule that way. Or don't lead that way. Number five, the complementarian would say, well, most of church history has adhered to the complementarian view as well. Once all is said and done, you've got to take into account other people who have believed this for a long time. Now, in response to this, the response comes from egalitarians, which would simply be basically the same as the arguments that were given for earlier, but we'll just go over these quickly. Number one, dealing with number one, that the Bible illustrates male leadership from the beginning, would state that these illustrations of male leadership were descriptive, not prescriptive. In other words, male leadership like slavery was a cultural phenomenon that God chose not to overthrow at the time. Number two, which is answering the idea that Eve was created as a completer for Adam, and that Adam was lacking and Eve was lacking, and only together do they become the image of God. They would say, well, it's agreed that woman was created to complete humanity, not necessarily man. This does not necessitate that there is a functional hierarchy that God initiated. The male leadership, rulership, domination, whatever name it goes by, was the product of the fall, not creation. We've already gone through that. Number three, which is Paul is constantly having to address women who are failing to understand the importance of their role and kind of creating a liberation movement. Paul was writing to cultural situations that do not demand universal application. For example, Paul wrote to Timothy in Ephesus, women who were formerly cult prostitutes and uneducated, typically only receiving secondhand information from their husbands, were attempting to fill the pulpit. He uses Eve to illustrate how destructive secondhand information can be, because Eve did not get her instructions directly from God, got him secondhand through Adam is the argument. I'm not saying this is a good argument. This is about the last argument I would use, but he uses Eve to illustrate how destructive secondhand argument can be. He does not use the events in the garden as a universal principle. Paul's command here is purely cultural, because it's very difficult to get past that Paul refers back to the garden, back to creation, whenever he says that women cannot teach, or he does not allow a woman to exercise authority over a man. Very difficult to get by. And the only way that I saw that the complementarian or the egalitarian would sometimes get by this was to state that it's secondhand information that he's referring to. That's the principle. It's bad to teach off of secondhand information. And the women in the culture of Paul's day were only receiving teaching through their husbands, not directly from the church. Take it, read it. Maybe you'll understand it later. I don't think it's a good one to argue anyway, so... If you don't understand it, I'm not too upset about it, because it's not very good. The New Testament writers constantly have to address men who abuse their leadership roles. The answer would be these passages in the New Testament do not regulate on how husbands are to rule, but how they are to relate. They are to love their wives and not rule over them. And then, number five, most of church history has adhered to a complementarian view. They would respond by stating, it is a sad fact that the history of the church is littered with abusive relationships coming from man's sinful tendency to dominate. Christians abused the Jews, they justified slavery, and they forced people to convert during the Inquisitions. Any appeal to history, especially Christian history, carries little weight in these areas and might even work against the complementarian view, which I would agree. I wanted to appeal too much to history about it. Greg Johnson says this. He says, of the 250 culture studies, males dominate in almost all. Males are almost always the rule makers, hunters, builders, fashioners of weapons, workers in metal, wood, or stone. Women are mostly caregivers and most involved in child rearing. The fact that these universals transcend divergent animal groups and cultures suggests that there must be predeterminants of gender-related behavior. He states that in the book Discovering Biblical Manhood and Woman, or Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. Now, let me tell you a few of the biological differences. I think this will help us as we close this down. Some of the biological differences. Women store more fat and retain more heat. Why would women store more fat and retain more heat? I mean, these are just biological facts. It's not theological anymore. So, childbearing. Have more white blood cells, B and T, lymphocytes, and can fight off infection faster. Why again? Again, the same thing. Are more perceptive due to a more responsive sensory system, finer body hair, more acute sense of hearing, taste, touch, and smell. Once again, the same type of role that we're talking about, this role of nurturing and nesting. Can discriminate color better. I thought this was interesting. Can discriminate color better, particularly in the red end of the spectrum. I was talking to my eye doctor the other day about this to verify it, and he said, yes, I think he said that women have like a 20 times higher ability to discriminate with color better. And a lot of people would say that's to recognize whenever there's fever, rashes, that sort of stuff within children. Have less testosterone, not that you all needed to know this, but more patient, stay in immediate family longer. Another thing is that a baby's cry triggers involuntary responses. You women can fill in the blanks there. produce more cortisol during prolonged stressful situations. Cortisol reduces serotonin, which leads to depression. Now, this is the way women deal with stressful situations. Now, look at some of the things about men. Have a 10% higher metabolic rate. Have 50% more muscle mass. Have more sweat glands to dissipate heat faster. Now, what are we getting to here? What's that? 100. Yeah. Have 10% more red blood cells instead of white blood cells, which wounds heal faster instead of infections. Have 15 times higher testosterone after puberty. We're more aggressive because of this. I heard that whenever you look in the prisons, you know, you have a much, much higher testosterone rate among even the men there because they're so aggressive. Or they have higher testosterone, which makes them more aggressive. More sexually active, enjoy competitive sports, leave immediate family earlier, and are prone to argue. I didn't make those up. Those were written there. So, also produce more testosterone during prolonged stressful times, giving more endurance but are more apt to have hypertension. So we deal with stress differently. One produces depression, one produces heart attacks. So you can clearly see that there's a difference biologically. That's what we're trying to get at here. We are biologically equipped for different roles. Now, one thing that I want to be able to state in this is that the roles, I think, sometimes, and I've been going around talking to a few people about this recently, and I talk to women who are really disturbed about some of these issues that are more towards the egalitarian side because of the disturbances. And I say, you know, is it the roles that are looked down upon to you? Is that the reason why you're in this kind of a women's liberation attitude? Is because your roles are not elevated high, or because your person is not elevated high? And they thought about that. Most of them would say both, I guess. But I think that they're right in the sense. I think that a lot of times they're right whenever they state that males do not elevate the roles of women and see the importance of these roles, of the nurturer, of the motherhood, of the sensitivity, of the being emotionally acute, having female intuition. I think that guys, because of who we are, devalue that quite a bit. And we almost switch the roles to state it this way. You stay home and take care of the kids and do your thing so that we can go work and we can do the things that are really important. Whenever in my mind, it's the exact opposite. We work so that we can support you doing the really important things. I don't think there's any more important thing in this entire world than caring for children. I mean, if you look at the statistics, it's very clear that children, everybody who has become a believer, 80% to 90% of them become believers by the age of 12. I mean, that is the formative years. That's whenever it's important. That's whenever you have the impact upon children. And to devalue that role, which is, I believe, the most important role in all of society, and I've just demonstrated how it's the most important role in the church as well. To be able to elevate that to the importance that it is, I think that women would gain their dignity. I think that it wouldn't be something that it would be looked down upon. I think this complementarian view shows how the dignity is in both. I mean, I'm not trying to devalue man now to make a point. I think that man and woman both have high dignity and that their roles are extremely important, but I don't think it's sometimes the devaluing of women that carries the problem. I think it's the devaluing of the roles that women carry. Quickly, let me go through this slide here. It's kind of a summary slide. This shows the complementarian anthropology. Male and female, there's ontological equality. Both are equal in their being. But whenever you come down to different traits, you've got primary traits. The male's primary trait is to be independent, logical, and ambitious. The female's primary traits are to be relational, emotionally sensitive, and compassionate. Notice the difference. Independent, relational, logical, emotionally sensitive, ambitious, compassionate. Ambitious, willing to do anything, compassionate, looking after people, being able to see the needs. Whereas ambitious kind of doesn't look towards that. Biological traits, strong, heals quick, high testosterone. Biological traits of women, perceptive, fights infection, low testosterone. And then this produces the functional hierarchy. There's a Trinitarian analogy in which men are compared to the Father, and then women are compared to the Son. Again, ontological equality, functional hierarchy within the Trinity. I don't think it's any devalue at all to be compared to the Son. Theological function, leader, authority, helper, completer. Family function, worker. Family function, childbearer. Primary function within the church, teaching and evangelism for men. Secondary would be encouragement and mercy. For women, the primary would be encouragement and mercy, but the secondary, teaching and evangelism. Primary marital need, if there's not anything more clear than through, you know, what we've stated so far, it states it just as clear in Scripture. Men need respect and women need love. And that's very clear. See to it that the women respect their husbands. Men, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Very clear. Theologically, very clear about the roles of men and women and the needs of men and women. And then the effects of the fall. And I think this is very important for us to keep in mind. I'm just repeating something we've already stated. But the effects of fall, the passive punishment to women to men is hardship and work. But the active sin tendency that men have inherited is that we abuse authority and we rule harshly. For women, the passive punishment is pain and childbirth. But the active sin tendency that they have inherited is a desire to rule over the man or rebel against their authority, or rebel even against their role, possibly. And so I think it's, while all this has been said, and we certainly, I'm not saying that everybody's going to agree with me on every point that we've put forth so far, the issues have been laid out. If nothing else we get out of this, I hope we get that men and women need each other, and that we elevate the other's role very highly and esteem it very highly. And I think that at least then we would be for sure functioning theologically proper. And with that, we end our class.
Scene 1, Apple, take 1.